is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
A cage match. That's what NBC News wanted last night in the Republican debate, a cage match. Ted Cruz, one of the first to call them out. Hey, what do you want, a cage match? You're asking Donald Trump if he's a cartoon character. You're asking Marco Rubio if he can, you know, lash out. You're asking Ben Carson if he can do math. You're asking John Kasich if he can insult people. Next, why don't we talk about things that matter, things of substance? You know, that's what they're asking about. The debate was pretty decent, but the hands-down winner, I thought, was Marco Rubio. I thought Marco Rubio came out, you know, and he had the line of the night saying the biggest super PAC going for the Democrats, the biggest super PAC going is the mainstream media like you guys. The biggest loser of the night, clearly, the moderators. I mean, the questions were a joke. Are you a cartoon character? Ben Carson, can you do math? I mean, really? Jeb Bush, your numbers are falling. Does this mean your campaign's over? I got an idea. Oh, and then another one. Chris Christie. We'll get this soundbite in a second for you as well. Chris Christie. They asked him about fantasy football. He said, really? We're sitting here talking about fantasy. We've got $19 trillion in debt. We've got foreign policy in a shambles. We've got this problem and that problem. And you want to talk about fantasy football? I mean, it was, ugh. It's Thursday. It's the Steve Gruber Show. Welcome aboard. Welcome aboard, brought to you in part by Mesa Today. Good business, good schools, and great health. Mesa bringing this part of the program. And let's start with Marco Rubio. We've got a little bit of a sample of Marco Rubio at the debate last night responding to some of the nonsense. Go.
If I may just say, Mr. Trump, you had been, let me follow up on this for just a moment. You had talked a little bit about Marco Rubio. I think you called him Mark Zuckerberg's personal senator because he was in favor of the H-1B.
I never said that.
So this was an erroneous article the whole way
He's
around?
He's got another gentleman in Florida who happens to be a very nice guy, but not...
My apologies. I'm sorry.
Everybody's really doing some bad facts.
Since I've been mentioned, can I respond?
Yes, you may.
Okay. You know, the Democrats have the ultimate super PAC. It's called the mainstream media. Who every single day, and I'll tell you why. Last week, Hillary Clinton went before a committee. She admitted she had sent emails to her family saying, hey, this attack in Benghazi was caused by al-Qaeda-like elements. She spent over a week telling the families of those victims and the American people that it was because of a video. And yet the mainstream media is going around saying it was the greatest week in Hillary Clinton's campaign. It was the week she got exposed as a liar. It was the week that she got exposed as a liar. But she has her super PAC helping her out, the American mainstream media.
Senator Rubio, thank you very much. I'd like to introduce my colleague,
exactly
Rick
right.
Santelli.
Stop right there. You know, the fact of the matter is, the moderators were outmatched. These moderators, I've seen one of them before. They're not particularly well-known media personalities, but I'd seen them before. But geez, we deserve better. We deserve better in a debate. We don't need to see, drag them through the mud nonsense. But I saw some good stuff. I saw some good stuff from Donald Trump. I saw some good stuff from Chris Christie. I saw some great answers from Ted Cruz, as I mentioned. Good answers from Marco Rubio. A couple of decent ones from John Kasich. Although Kasich's got to get off this whole, you know, every answer starts with, in Ohio. Well, in our state of Ohio, well, that's great. But, you know, let's stop. Let's be a little bit more, let's get out there a little bit. And Ben Carson, I think he had a pretty decent night, too, so we'll see what happens. Let's see here. We do have the Chris Christie bite. Let's go ahead. This was telling as to where these moderators were trying to take this debate, which was into the mud. Go.
We have $19 trillion in debt. We have people out of work. We have ISIS and Al-Qaeda attacking us. And we're talking about fantasy football? Can we stop? Get the government to do what they're supposed to be doing. Secure our borders, protect our people, and support American values and American families.
Exactly. I mean, what? Just a joke. Hey, let's jump onto the hotline real quick. We got Brian cruising around in southern Michigan. Wants to make a comment on what happened last night. Brian, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Steve. This just demonstrates how classy and professional the candidates acted and how, like, weasels the press acts. If they didn't act like such weasels, we would have never ended up with Barack Hussein Obama. We would have never ended up with Bill Clinton. And we wouldn't be dealing with this idiotic gun debate or this Black Lives Matter nonsense. Cops would be respected in this country. But the press and the school systems, but I want to stick on the press, is primarily responsible for destroying this country.
Yeah, well, there's clearly some issues here, and it was demonstrated last night over and over and over again. I mean, it was embarrassing,
I'm glad they finally took them to task, the candidates. A lot of times, Republicans just sit back on their hands and they do nothing. It's about because the press is they're just a bunch of uneducated fools. It's easy to school them. Why don't we start schooling them?
That's a good question, Brian. That's why they vote
the way they do because they're not very bright. Yeah, like I watch O'Reilly sometimes, and Jesse Waters goes out there and interviews people from these elite colleges like Harvard and stuff, and the answers that these people are giving. And it's just like these people in the news. It's easy to school them. So why don't we start schooling America and stop letting the press school America? Because that's why we end up in the situation we're at, Steve.
No, there you go. All right. Appreciate you checking in, Brian. And you know, it's true. We need to, well, accountability is what we need more of. And I think that the candidates, I think you're right, the candidates demonstrate a level of professionalism, command of the subjects, and the ability to pick apart weasel questions when they come there. Weasel questions, no question. And it was flat out embarrassing to me, a lot of those questions. Anyhow, it is 14 after on this Thursday, doing the post-debate roundup. We're going to continue to break it down for you. We'll have some more sound. We'll have, Donald Trump and John Kasich and more. In case you missed it, we've got the highlights here for you. But I think that unquestioning, Marco Rubio came out and he looked terrific again. I just think that he had the debate again. Ben Carson a little quiet. Donald Trump didn't really make the kind of headway he'd like to. More in a moment right here on the Steve Gruber Show.
Delivering Michigan common sense with a big dose of truth and honesty.
And a question about last night's debate. Isn't CNBC supposed to be the business arm of NBC News? Now, bear in mind, I worked for NBC News for a number of years. I worked right there and did a lot of the things you see on TV today. I was right there in the trenches for 14 years. Many of those years with NBC News. So I have a pretty good handle on what it's like inside those big newsrooms. And people tell you, well, it's the liberal news media. You have, my friends, no idea. None. I can assure you that inside those big newsrooms, it's far more left than you realize. I was marginalized, demonized, because the last newsroom I was working in for NBC News had about 100 people in it, all the reporters, anchors, producers, whatnot. I was one of three people in the room that admitted to owning firearms. And the only on-air person that admitted owning firearms, I was a pariah. Really, I was a pariah. I mean, I'm not kidding you. It's what a joke. At any rate, let's see. What else do we have from the debate from last night? We've got, John Kasich didn't do anything to help his case, I don't believe. But here's a little bit of something from John Kasich we pulled out that I think, you know, he had some good comments. But not the evening. The big evening again, Marco Rubio and Dr. Carson had a good night. I think Chris Christie did okay, but here's a little bit from Kasich. All right, well, we're going to readjust that tape. It's right there, and sometimes you have that on live radio. And looking at it, what are your thoughts? Give me your feedback, 888-900-9966, or you can post your comments at stevegruber.com or on the Steve Gruber Show Facebook page. Just curious what your feedback is. And which one of these people, is there anybody here starting to emerge now? That's debate number three. Anybody emerging in your mind that, you know, could be moving up? Anybody that you think could be, you know, starting to show themselves in a way that you think might be, you know, something you could vote for and get behind and support? Some of these candidates are going to have to thin out. They are. I mean, we're not going to have 10 or 11 candidates come the 1st of January. It's just, it's not possible. So Donald Trump, again, did he win or lose? I don't think Donald Trump did anything to reestablish himself. You know, another thing about the media, if you didn't see this, Trump has been in Iowa for the last couple of days leading up to the debate because he has slipped behind Ben Carson there. So he went and did something that's fairly unheard of. He went and said, listen, guys, I need your help. I need your votes. Why are you letting me down? You know, most people that would slip behind in the polls wouldn't admit it ever. He said, what am I doing wrong? What can I do to help you, and what can you do to help my campaign? I need you on February 1st, was his message. The mainstream media on that, his message on that from the media was, he's begging for votes. He's begging for votes. He's begging for, I mean, it doesn't matter. Every place was saying it. He's begging for votes. Donald Trump has lowered himself to begging for votes. You know, actually admitting that maybe your message isn't right and saying, hey, I'm going to work my tail off for you. I'm better than anybody else in this race. I will do better for you than anybody else in this race. What can I do to earn your trust and keep your trust? I just think it was so unheard of. The media was shocked, and so they reduced it to groveling. I'm not sure it was groveling. Anyhow, here's back to John Kasich. Here's some of that sound we were talking about.
You can't do it with empty promises. You know, these plans would put us trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. I actually have a plan. I'm the only one on this stage that has a plan that would create jobs, cut taxes, balance the budget, and can get it done because I'm realistic. You just don't make promises like this. Why don't we just give a chicken in every pot while we're, you know, coming up with these fantasy tax schemes? We'll just clean it up. Where are you going to clean it up? You have to deal with entitlements. You have to be in a position to control discretionary spending. You got to be creative and imaginative.
Yeah, his problem is that too many people are saying, well, we're going to throw 12 million immigrants out. We're going to, you know, cut to Obamacare. We're going to cut this and cut that. And he's right. He's right. Come on. Stop making promises, rhetorical promises, that you can't keep. But not a big night for him. And he could be one of the folks that's on the bubble. He has a strong machine in New Hampshire. That will keep him above water for a while. But if Kasich doesn't get some good turnout and some good votes, he will be in trouble. And you've also got Jeb Bush. You know, he has cut his staff back. He has cut his campaign back. And I don't think Jeb Bush did anything to help himself. Michigan's own Ben Carson took some time to talk about the flat tax. Let's hear just a little bit of what. But I mean, Ben Carson is number one right now. In the USA Today power poll, in Iowa, elsewhere, Michigan native. Here's what he had to say about the flat tax.
I've got to say.
I want to talk toxins.
Hold on, Gunnar. We're coming back to you in a minute. Becky's moving on.
Dr. Carson, let's talk about taxes. You have a flat tax plan of 10% flat taxes, and I've looked at it, and this is something that is very appealing to a lot of voters, but I've had a really tough time trying to make the math work on this. If you were to take a 10% tax with the numbers right now on total personal income, you're going to come in with bringing in $1.5 trillion. That is less than half of what we bring in right now. And by the way, it's going to leave us in a $2 trillion hole. So what analysis got you to the point where you think this will work?
Well, first of all, I didn't say that the rate would be 10%. I used the tithing analogy.
I understand okay? that, but if, but you, if rate, you look at the numbers, the you probably rate, have to get to 28%.
The rate is going to be much closer to 15%.
15% still leaves you with a $1.1 trillion hole.
You also have to get rid of all the deductions and all the loopholes. You also have
See,
to
See, what I find interesting about that, and I want to make it, I will get back to Dr. Carson, because it's a good answer and there's important stuff there. But who thought they were the star of that whole particular exchange there? Oh, yes, the moderator who wanted to jump in and say, I got you. Oh, I got you again. Oh, 15%. I got you. See the mentality we have here? And that's the problem with these debates is you have the, like Rubio said, the super PAC media working for Hillary Clinton. Back in a moment on the Steve Gruber Show.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
You'll take my life, but I'll take yours too. You fire a musket, but I'll run you through.
All righty, it's Thursday here on the program. And I'm encouraging your input on what happened last night on the stage there. CNBC, the moderators, just embarrassing. You know, trying to cause a food fight again. You know, this is the approach, apparently, for Republicans when in a debate the moderators try to get a fist fight going. And they were having none of it. Ted Cruz tore him down for it. Chris Christie tore him down for it. Marco Rubio tore him down for it. Hey, knock it off. Let's talk about something that matters. We'll get more of that coming up at the top of the hour. But we're going to shift gears for a moment here and talk about something that clearly the presidential candidates have talked about and will be talking about going forward, both Republicans and Democrats, and that is military strength and foreign policy and where we are with everything. Our next guest, Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow, Defense Programs, and the editor of the 2016 Index of U.S. Military Strength. Dakota, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Enjoying this.
Well, let's start with this. Let's get an overview, the 30,000-foot view. Because we hear all the time how America's military, we have the smallest Navy since World War I, the smallest Air Force, the weakest forces, so on and so forth. Fairly doom and gloom, and that primarily comes from the right. I don't know if it's accurate or if it's some of it's hyperbole. So explain to us, let's get a thumbnail version of it. Where are we with military strength in America in 2015?
Well, we have a shrinking military. It's an aging military in terms of the primary equipment it uses, getting older very rapidly, and it's also less ready. Probably a third of the force at any one time is ready to actually be employed. And this is in a world where we have an increasing number of competitors or enemies, and they are making investments in their own military capabilities to be dominant military powers in their respective regions. So a smaller, weaker military in a more dangerous world. And I think that's the big message right there. And it's relevant because if the world...
Now, hold on. Let me jump in there because because what would be said by Barack Obama would be, and I'll play devil's advocate for a moment, is that what we have is a quicker, stealthier, faster surgical strike military. I mean, that would be the retort, right?
It is, and we put a lot of money over decades in having a military that can deploy. The vast majority of our military is in the United States. To go anywhere to protect the U.S. interests, you have to deploy 3,000 to 8,000 miles away. So you're always going into somebody else's neighborhood and having to actually win that conflict, and it takes the ability to get there quickly and to be highly mobile. But you're only using a percentage of your force against the totality of your opponent. And so it's this differentiation in capacity, the size to do things necessary, that I think the president is missing out on.
Well, You know, this gives me pause, of course, because you spend your time looking at the status of America's military power and where our interests are being threatened around the world. So let's do this first. Let's take a look at where you see the most critical needs for us in maintaining a credible force, whether it's here at home or wherever it may be. Let's take a look around the world. Because let's talk about the fact that Russia is advancing in places like Syria. You've got the Islamic State that we're dealing with in different places. We've got what's going on in Afghanistan. Is the tide there? It doesn't seem to be going very well in our direction, plus all the other terrorist issues that we deal with on a 24-hour-a-day basis. Where are the biggest concerns, and where are your biggest concerns, Dakota?
Yeah, well, we looked at three key regions because of economic ties, access to markets, access to resources, and stable governments and how those might be threatened. And so where our interests are most severely threatened can be take place in Europe, the Middle East, and the Asia-Pacific area. So in Europe, Russia seeks to be the dominant military power. In the Middle East, you have Iran that's increasing its military capacity for mayhem, as well as a number of terrorist organizations that threaten regional stability. And in Asia-Pacific, it's terrorism based in Afghanistan, North Korea, and then the big guy is China, similarly to Russia trying to be the dominant military power. So the foundational interest here is stability in the world so that the United States can continue to reap benefits here at home with access to markets, trade arrangements, and an affiliation with like-minded governments. And where you have destabilization, it not only affects the local countries in that region, but how the United States interests are similarly affected. So it's our ability to keep bad people from doing bad things that destabilize regions that really is the overarching concern.
Okay, so let's start to look where, you know, we need to focus more attention. We know what the concerns are, we know what our threats are, and our the things that we face on a daily basis. So let's start with the Navy. We know that the Chinese are building islands, man-made islands in the South China Sea. We just had a drive-by by one of our ships over there, a destroyer that the Chinese said, "You can't be here. You're in, you know, violating our space," and we're like, no, this is international water. Let's start with the readiness of the United States Navy today and where you think we're lacking and where things should and could be improved.
So historical record indicates, and a number of studies for the last 30 years, so that tells us the Navy should be roughly 350 ships. Because of budget constraints, the Navy has resigned itself to a bare minimum of 308. So there are already about 45 or so ships less in their own plans. What they actually have is 272. So just the nature of ship deployments and yard maintenance and crew usage, you only have about a third of the Navy out at any one time, and that's about 90 ships. But that's globally. So the U.S. Navy being able to go up against China is roughly 45 ships or thereabouts. China itself has about 250 or 300 in that region. They're developing aircraft carrier capabilities, advanced submarines, and because it's in their home waters, they have shore-based maritime aircraft and cruise missiles that are able to reach out hundreds of miles. So that's an asset they have to use against our Navy. So
clearly, and those aircraft carriers.
War.
Yeah, we have. What is it? Something like 35% of the world's trade, 40%, a huge amount of the world's trade passes through the South China Sea. So,
correct.
You know, historically, you and I and everybody else has heard about the Suez Canal and different important waterways in this world that need to be protected and looked after. The South China Sea, $4 trillion or $5 trillion a year passes through there, about 40% of the annual trade on the planet. It's an immense number. And so the Chinese, as you mentioned, developing flat tops, developing a blue water navy so they can protect it clearly. On the line with Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow at the Defense Programs and editor of the 2016 Index of U.S. Military Strength. And Dakota, sit tight right there. We're going to come back and talk more about the Marines, the Army that's out there at a much reduced rate than it was in the past. And more importantly, we're going to get to a question about military officers, because there are all these stories out there that ever since Barack Obama took office, that officers have been either resigning or getting fired or getting demoted. We want to find out if that's a, you know, is that fact or fiction? We're going to get to the bottom of it. Dakota, sit tight. It's Thursday right here on the Steve Gruber Show. We appreciate your support. You can find out more at stevegruber.com. Stevegruber.com. Check it out right now. We'll be right back.
Keeping you in touch with Michigan and the world.
Heading into 2016, national security is big of an issue this year as it has ever been in my lifetime when it comes to voting. And our security is of different concerns now. You know, when I was growing up, it was the Russians and the Cold War that we worried about all the time. Now it's a different concern, a different threat. Dakota Wood is here, Senior Research Fellow, Defense Programs, and editor of the 2016 Index of U.S. Military Strength. Let me ask you about that thing that I mentioned before the break there, Dakota, which is, you know, there are all these stories and blogs floating around saying that Barack Obama basically has gutted the military's brass, that the military commanders, generals, captains, colonels have en masse been either relieved, forced to retire, fired, whatever you'd like to call it. Is there any truth to that?
No, I think it's mostly myth. The story was going around about 2 years ago at the peak of that interest. I still have lots of friends who are fairly senior levels in the military, active duty. They don't validate any of that. And most of the high-profile cases of somebody being relieved was actually for cause. It was abuse of authority, some kind of corrupt practices, something along those lines. So, you know, people rotate in and out of the military all the time. There is a natural turnover for retirements and those kinds of things at the upper levels. So when something, there is a dispute by a general officer and presidential policy, it's a rare exception. And I just don't think the evidence backs up that there's this evisceration of the officer corps.
Fair enough. All right, so let's move on to military readiness. Let's start with the United States Army. Let's start with what you see there and the biggest concerns you have.
Just about 3 years ago, they had 45 brigades. They're now down to 32. So they've dropped by a third. We assess that they actually need about 50 based on historical use and a number of major studies. So the Chief of Staff of the Army has said only about a third of those remaining brigades are actually ready, and they continue to shrink in size. They're actually probably on their way to 420,000, which would bring them into the upper 20s in brigades. We only have two brigades in Europe. Neither one of them are armored. We only have one in Korea as a backstop to the Republic of Korean military. So we just don't have the throw weight we used to have to act as a deterrent against people like Russia, Iran, and China.
How about, let's see, the United States Air Force next here on the list?
They're actually pretty strong in the number of airplanes they have. The problem with their aircraft is they're very, very old. So over 90% of the fleet that they have is used up 80-some-odd plus percent of the lifespan of these airplanes. Build an airplane to fly a certain number of hours, and they've been flying so much that they're literally flying the wings off their planes. So that's the chief concern with the Air Force.
All right, I did see that a new B-2 stealth bomber, a new generation, has been ordered, so at least there's something new in the pipeline. Down the list here, the United States Marines. Obviously, the Marines get a lot of press for, you know, being the guys first in, last out. Where are we with the United States Marines?
For decades, they've held at 27 battalions. They're now down to 23, and yet the demand is higher than ever for Marine Corps infantry battalions that really is the nucleus of most of their formations. We've assessed at the Heritage Foundation that they actually need about 36, you know, based on real-world current demand. So a much-reduced Marine Corps, highly used. A Marine unit will deploy for 7 months, come home for 14, and then turn right back out and around and go back out for 7. So the force is getting worn out pretty quickly, driven by the amount of money that they have to retain sufficient people to have enough units.
Is that what it comes down to? I mean, we have enough people in this country, obviously, to fill those positions if we wanted to increase the Army by a number of battalions of the U.S. Marines. How big is it? Just help me out here, because I've decided I don't know how many people are in a battalion. How many?
It's about 800 people. So that's a rough order for the Army. Brigade is roughly 5,000. So those are really useful references when you start totaling things up. When the Army was at 45 brigades, they had about 520,000 people. They're now down below 490 on their way to 450,000. So if you think about any other industry shedding 100,000 people in just a year or two, there would be a national outcry and certainly a warning sign that something was wrong. This is what's happening to America's Army. And it just doesn't rate much news in the newspapers these days.
Right. I guess a few years ago, I was on board the USS Michigan, a Trident-class nuclear submarine, a boomer, last line of defense. At least we still have those, right? I believe the Trident-class nuclear submarines are still state-of-the-art. Would that be safe to say? Are those getting old as well?
The age of a submarine is driven by its reactor. So it's fueled up once, goes out for 15 or 20 years, and then comes back in to have the reactor refueled. So the submarine fleet is currently in good condition. It really is. But the Navy looks at when those need to be replaced, and the boomer replacement really needs to start coming online in about 10 years, and that's going to be a huge cost. We come back to the money issue again, and underinvestment in our military services, which accumulate problems over time.
All right. Well, I suppose the only good news is we're not in a major conflict at the moment. We've scaled back several of the places we are. But you're right, it comes back to money. It comes back to, I think, more accurately, Dakota, priorities. Dakota Wood, I'll give you 20 seconds for the last word.
Well, yeah, the United States needs to figure out what role it wants to play. And if we want to be an influence in the world, have people on our team as opposed to going elsewhere, and have access to global markets that feed jobs back here at home, you've got to have the military might that backs up diplomacy and economic initiatives, and we just aren't making the proper investment there.
What an education it's been. I hope you guys at home were taking notes on that, because that was an education in the United States military strength and readiness. Dakota Wood, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
There you have it. Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow, Defense Programs, and the editor of the 2016 Index of United States Military Strength. You learned something this morning, now, didn't you? It's Thursday. This is the Steve Gruber Show.